This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. I'm so excited for today. Andre Pavlov, professor of finance at SFU Beattie School of Business, is back.
He's back. I don't know how many times Andre's been on the show.
More than five.
But I do feel like we haven't had him on for a while. And I feel like there could not have been a better moment and a better discussion. That was it was fantastic getting his thoughts on the current market and regulatory environment we are in.
You know, it was about 5 years ago or so when we had Andre Pavlov debate Tom Davidoff
on the show.
Live on the show. Well, it wasn't live.
It wasn't but it was unedited.
And it was unedited.
And we literally, I remember somebody at the time said, "Hey, I heard that debate. Were you guys even there?" It wasn't like we were moderating it. It was just, we set up mics and had them just go back and forth for about an hour and 15 minutes. But it was a fascinating watch at two very different approaches to regulating the economy.
That episode still lives on Spotify and Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. You can find that show. And of course, at our website.
Very, very applicable. The one thing I will say about today, here's the thing. We have asked so many people, why so much inventory right now?
Yes.
We put that to Andre Pavlov, and I think he came up with the most compelling reason yet.
Yes.
And maybe we'll just leave it there.
Yeah.
Because wait for it. It will blow some people's minds. It definitely blew your hair back, and it blew my
mind. What's left of it. Here's the thing. I talked about that a lot lately, and I mean, it makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
But it's, anyways, save it for the show.
Yeah.
There's so many great takeaways. I love having Andre in studio. I love having him on the podcast. All around, just fantastic guy. Super interesting. Can't wait.
Absolutely. But before we get to that, Adam, we have the MLA Newswire Weekly. This is a pre-sale update brought to you by the MLA Canada Advisory Team.
Yes.
What has Brad got in the hopper this week? The headline is just new tenancy rules.
No, is it?
Come on. It is.
Brad, new tenancy rules. How about a... dramatic changes to new tenancy rules. I'm going to start coming up with these headlines.
You know what? I don't even know if I'll call it a headline. Maybe just a topic. new tenancy rules. They are here.
Right.
They are impactful. And actually, before we get to the MLA Newswire Weekly, we should say we talk about the new tenancy rules with Andre this week.
Yeah.
But Bill 14, implemented in British Columbia, brings several significant changes to the Residential Tenancy Act to enhance tenant protection and landlord accountability. Let's just detail these very quickly.
So there's a new landlord use web portal that's launching to generate official notices for ending tenancy.
So you have to use the web portal, to generate a notice to end tenancy. That's already in place. It came online July 18th, 2024. The notice to end a tenancy, and this is big in the real estate industry.
One.
Well, it's big in our industry, I feel like, for sure. From 2 to 4 months is the notice now. And usually... it's basically a month added to that because you're not doing it the first of the month. So it's basically a five-month...
Explain that. You mean usually you have to give notice by the end of the month. So there's
right. So we're in July. If I gave notice to a tenant today, July's a wash. So then it's August, September, October, November. You're looking at December 1. Yeah. And that would have been even 3 weeks ago. If it was July 2nd, July's a wash.
Sure.
So for most notices now, we're looking at probably 4.5-5 months. What that does to the resale market, specifically tenanted units, is still...
And we talk about that today.
It's up for interpretation, but Andre's got thoughts.
Yes. Number 3 is the eviction restrictions. So there's new evictions for converting rental units to non-residential units. That's going to be eliminated entirely.
And last, if you move back into a home that was rented out, you now cannot live there for only 6 months and re-rent it out, you have to live there for 12 months. And if you get caught, there's very steep penalties.
Yeah, we talk about that on the show today too.
Exactly. So a lot of these are enhancing tenant protection, landlord accountability, but it does paint a difficult picture in terms of hurdles for current and future landlords. I think this is going to have an impact on real estate investment in British Columbia.
Yeah, well, especially when investor-owner landlords make up about 43% of the rental stock.
This is and Wendy Waters talked about this too. This is shocking that almost half of all rentals in British Columbia are mom-and-pop investors.
Right. Pat yourself on the back, mom-and-pop. Anyways, this is big news. And if you like that, Matt.
Yeah, if you like that, subscribe to the MLA Newswire, a daily email roundup of the latest real estate news and market insights. Visit MLAcanada.com to subscribe today.
And Matt, what else do we have? We're, of course, sponsored by Scalina Real Estate, which is our real estate team in Vancouver. Really excited about this. Is just launched today.
Well, yeah, and we're doing the intro a couple of days before this launches. So we should say this coming weekend, if you're listening to the podcast when it drops, we talked a little bit about this listing last week, 2656 East 7th. It's now on VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This house has got it all. It's got it all. What did you say? You said most houses when you move in, you go, okay, I got to do X, Y, Z. This is the house where all of that has been done. It has a brand new heat pump with AC. Yeah. It has a new furnace.
EV charger.
It has an EV charger, brand new parking pad. It's got a brand new legal suite downstairs, new bathrooms, an added bedroom,
new windows,
good insulation in the attic. It's kind of got, the house was recently painted.
It's a mechanically dialed house.
New plumbing. upgraded electrical panel. Do we need to go on? Amps.
I know. It's the kind of house that I would look at and I'd say, I don't have to do anything.
You don't have to do anything. And it's on a standard lot and it's right by Trout Lake, the Commercial Drive SkyTrain station, but still on a quiet tree-lined street. This
50s
is
50s house too. There's something about 50s houses that I just really love.
Exactly. 2656 East 7th. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for more information. And we'll be open this weekend. We're unable to show until Saturday, 2 to 4.
I'm there Saturday.
You're there Saturday, 2 to 4.
Yes. Can't wait.
Absolutely.
I've got the cookies in the oven.
You're baking cookies. While you're there, though, definitely hit sell with us because that's where you download the sold plan.
Yeah, Matt. The sold plan stands for start on launch date. And it's our step-by-step guide for getting top dollar in the shortest amount of time for your property. And really, it really is step-by-step. Here's what you do. It's an outline. There's even a checklist. I love it.
No, it's fantastic.
And you can get that over.
There's a reason why it's our most downloaded document of all time.
You can get that, of course, over at our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Just click sell with us and it's an instant download. But without further ado, Matt, let's cut to this conversation with Andre Pavlov. That's Professor Andre Pavlov to you.
Absolutely. Enjoy. This was a fantastic talk.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with Andre Pavlov. He is a professor of finance at SFU Beatty School of Business and past guest fan favorite, for sure.
Past guest fan favorite, yeah.
Welcome back to the show, Andre. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Great to see you.
Can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a professor of finance at the Beatty School at Simon Fraser University. I've been doing housing research and real estate research ever since I got my PhD in that field from UCLA, and a lot of articles and a lot of theoretical work. But also being in Vancouver, of course, I can't help but being involved in the public discussion. So lots of thoughts on how our policy is going and really how it's gone wrong.
Right. So I feel like we've talked to a lot of people before we get, like, I think we should just jump into policy, right? Because it feels like in the last couple of years, we've moved from demand measure to everybody at least telling a narrative of needing more supply. And there's been a series from at all levels of government, a series of changes trying to create fewer obstacles to more supply. Just curious generally how you think things are going.
Gee, I mean, that's a really good question. It's funny how you frame it. The government has focused on supply. From what I've seen from all three levels of government, really, most of that is just talk. So we're talking about supply and we'd like to see supply increase, which is a positive change from before when supply wasn't even on the radar. So at least now it supplies front and center. But the actual policies that we implement, in my view, are backfiring. They're doing exactly the opposite thing of encouraging supply. And to give you a simple example, the last federal budget called for 3.9 million homes to be built in Canada. So 3.9 million homes is a lot, and that's probably what we need. In fact, I would say this is the bare minimum of what we need over the next decade if we're going to house all the people who are already here and who want to come here. So it's a good number. I like that number. The problem with that number is that it takes $2 trillion just in construction costs to build those 3.9 million homes. Do the math. I've done it a couple of times. It's $2 trillion. So when the federal government spends $50 billion or $25 billion or something like that, which are big numbers, that's nothing. That doesn't even move the needle on the $2 trillion that we need. So the only way the $2 trillion is going to happen is through private investment in housing. And of course, the problem is that all three levels of government have been working very hard to discourage housing investment. We've chased away investors, we've raised their capital gain rates, we've increased all kinds of vacancy taxes and other undermined property rights in all kinds of other ways. I just don't see who in their right mind is going to put up that kind of money in Canadian housing.
Does that number, $2 trillion, does that include infrastructure updates to support the housing?
That's a very good question. So no, that would be another probably $1 trillion in roads and sewers and electric power and all that. That second one traditionally has been from the government. So that I'm hoping that that's still the case, although a lot of it can be done privately and paid for by user fees. The $2 trillion is just, I mean, just take 4 million homes approximately. You multiply it by 500,000, which is what it takes to build a typical home. That gets you $2 trillion exactly. So this doesn't cover the cost of land and doesn't cover the cost of infrastructure.
And probably in terms of the timelines on something like that, I'm just thinking, like, even if we had the money to build the housing, do we have the trades to build it?
That's obvious another question, and we don't. In Vancouver, certainly we're short. Yeah. Other places are not. It is a concern, but I'm a little less worried about that because if you offer enough incentives, people will come from other places.
Right.
From the people who come from abroad, people will come from other parts of Canada, and there's technological innovation that makes it faster and easier for trades to work. Although, to allow for that to happen, any of that to happen, we've got to simplify our building code. So one of the obstacles we've put up to new construction is our latest building code in BC. I'm not a builder, I'm not an engineer, so I cannot read that code. But friends of mine who are tell me that it's absolutely insane. It is designed to make it very, very difficult to build. And the building code should be much simpler. It should only be concerned with safety and health and safety. So we want to make sure our buildings don't fall when there is an earthquake. But that's all there is to it. And instead, to build a simple single-family home that's been built millions of times in Vancouver, you have 21 inspections, right? So that's pretty absurd and has been absurd, has not improved. And the new building code makes it even worse. It's not just that it's complicated, it's also subject to interpretation. So now you've got to have a building code in consultant who gets to interpret the code. And of course, different consultants interpret it differently. It's a real mess. So that doesn't help our construction. To give you a simple example, SFU just made an announcement that they're building a new student housing complex. Fantastic, right? It's going to host 450 students. It's kind of designed for a little bit more mature students, perhaps with families. It looks excellent. Well, it's going to take 3 years to build. It's scheduled to open in 2027. And I did the math on the cost, and I can't remember that number precisely, but it was really very, very high. It was 200 plus thousand, just in construction cost, just for student housing. And that tells you that even when the government is building, they struggle to bring the product to market, even when presumably all the roadblocks are removed for them. So the first step there, if we want to build more housing, we need to simplify the building code and makes it quick and cheap and not risky to build.
You know, it makes me think, I'm trying to frame this question, a municipal level kind of question, because you mentioned, you know, building in Vancouver. We used to talk a lot about municipal politics on the show, or at least we talked more about it, but I'm kind of curious. I remember Ken Sim saying in his, before he got elected, that there was going to be a 3-day turnaround on certain permits. I'm just curious what your take is on maybe Ken Sim as a mayor and the council, and if they've actually made steps to improve housing in a kind of meaningful way, the building of housing.
Yeah, so I love that proposal of 3-3-3-1 or whatever it was. So it was 3 days for renovation, 3 weeks for a single family home, and then the last one was 1 year for a multifamily building. We're clearly not there yet. And, you know, I've seen a few meetings and speeches by Mayor Sim, and every time he brings that up and he talks about how it's going to happen, maybe there is some progress there, but we're not at that level. And part of the problem, obviously, is because it's very difficult to reorganize the bureaucracy of City Hall. But another one is the building code that I mentioned. When the building code is so complicated, it's very difficult to, I mean, you just have a lot of approvals that need to happen. Mm-hmm. And often those different departments are in conflict, so they need to talk to each other. And in fact, they don't talk to each other. They fight with each other through the applicant. So the first step is to simplify the requirements for buildings, limit only to health and safety, and possibly impact on neighbors. That's all there needs to be in a building code. And then put very hard term limits on the review process. And it's not a yes or a no. It's like, if it's a no, you need to tell me what part of the building code is violated in my proposal and how I need to fix it. So it goes, otherwise it's very easy to say, oh sure, we'll respond to all applications in 3 days. It will be no to everyone. So obviously that's not going to
help. What's your take on the mayor's term so far, just generally?
Well, he started with a number of interesting and great policy proposals and implementations, like the dropping of the road tax and improving traffic and this and that. But more recently, I mean, the vacancy tax remains in place, and that's devastating to Vancouver housing, especially rental housing. It really turns rental housing into a toxic asset, because the moment you let someone in, you can't kick them out, right? And, well, that's more on the Tenancy Act. But the Vacancy Act is a problem because it undermines property rights. It's your building, it's your property, and you can't leave a unit empty for whatever reason, even if the reason is to renovate it and make it better like that. So that's still in place, hasn't been removed. In fact, the rate has gone up. Property taxes have gone up 10%, more than 10% last time around, with talk of more increases going forward. 10% is the first double-digit increase in the history of Vancouver ever. And that came, you know, from administration that was basically elected from homeowners, from what I understand. I'm not a political scientist, but the commentary was most of the homeowners voted, and they voted for Ken Sim, and then to get stuck with the highest tax increase on record is a bit puzzling. And if the taxes in Vancouver were low, that wouldn't be a problem. The problem, the issue is, of course, Vancouver has the highest property taxes in Canada. Rates are low, but when you multiply rates by high values, the dollar amount is the highest in Canada. And to make that even higher by double digits, it's really insult to injury.
I'm just thinking about, so the vacancy tax, like, do you ever see that actually going away? I mean, it seems like once these are implemented, they seem to stick.
Right, and both the provincial and the municipal governments in Vancouver have been very successful at framing this as really a no-cost way to increase rental supply. We're going to take those empty units and we're going to force their owners to rent them, and there's no cost to that, and it's all great. And most people believe it. Surveys show that 60-70% of respondents like this tax and support it. What I think people fail to realize is that, sure, you're taking some of the current empty units and putting them in the rental pool. That's fine. I agree with that. But at the same time, you're making it riskier and more expensive to invest in residential real estate. So you get fewer units. And in fact, that's exactly what we observed. So in the city of Vancouver, I think there was about 5,000 units that got occupied because of the vacancy tax. Municipal and provincial. So that's a sizable number. That's very respectable. The issue is that we lost 2,500 units in new construction in the first year after the provincial tax was implemented.
I just want to unpack that. So for people that maybe are at home and aren't quite clear on this, but we make it riskier for investors with the vacancy tax. We're talking a little bit about the Residential Tenancy Act, making it riskier now for investors. Why do we care about making it riskier for investors?
You know, that's precisely the point. It's people, I don't think people make that connection. And that connection, in my view, is very clear. The moment you undermine property rights by telling people what they can and cannot do, you make it riskier. Because take the vacancy issue, for example. So in the past, you can occupy a unit, you can leave it empty, you can rent it, you can do all these options. And life is complicated, so you may be doing that for all kinds of legitimate reasons. Now you can't leave it empty. So one of those options is off the table. And of course, that makes it now riskier. So if you have to move because of your job or family or life in general, suddenly you have no option to just leave your place empty. You have to either occupy it or rent it. Well, that makes it riskier, so that increases the cost of capital. So sure, people will still invest, but they'll require higher rate of return on that investment because now they have less flexibility. And when you require higher rate of return on the investment, you get less investment. Only the projects that are incredibly profitable get the go-ahead. Everything else gets scrapped because no one can overcome all this bureaucratic and administrative hurdles that just add layer upon layer of risk, vacancy being the one of those layers.
And, you know, it makes me think, and we were talking to somebody the other day about this, but a good example is the basement suite in Vancouver, right? Where it's really, you know, especially an unauthorized suite where it's like, okay, you don't have to rent it out. Right, it's not subject to the empty homes tax, and I feel like right now, so many people I talk to are like the risk, whether it's through the Residential Tenancy Act, well, that especially is just the reward's not there. Like it doesn't actually, whatever you're going to make, $2,200, $2,500, $3,000 a month, whatever it is just not that reward is not there. So then they don't rent it out, and that's one unit that's off the market. Like as opposed to building new housing, I think the rental pool is actually shrinking because of these rules where people, you know, just regular folks who could add housing stock are not doing it because it's like, this is terrifying.
So that's a slightly different issue, which is not the vacancy tax, it's the Residential Tenancy Act, which
right,
is a complete disaster. It's entirely skewed towards the tenants.
Right. But just another layer of the undermining property rights.
Sure.
In a way that
Sure. So now you need that new
real estate.
Now you need that new 4-month notice, which 4 months doesn't sound like a lot if you're in the building and everything. But if you're trying to sell, well, 4 months really translates into 5 or even 6 months de facto. So now you're going to have to find a buyer with 6 month closing window. And a lot can change in 6 months and that buyer can walk away. By actually letting a tenant in your property, you're really undermining your options to sell. And life is unpredictable. You may have no intention to sell right now, but you'd like to be able to if something happens. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. Could be another investment opportunity, a job opportunity, family, whatever. Could be a good thing or a bad thing. As a property owner, you have to be able to sell. And right now, in the 4 month notice that you need to give to a potential tenant, you need 6 months closing. So that's that. The cost of that alone outweighs the rent you're going to collect. And then, of course, if you happen to have a bad tenant who's noisy or causes nuisance in other ways, you just can't evict them. And it used to be that at least if someone doesn't pay, you can evict them. Now even that is in question. So you can be stuck with someone for many years, decades, and really unable to evict them. And you really regret that initial decision to rent your unit. So then people don't.
So I just want to, and maybe just because I'm thinking we're talking about the layers of risk in the market, but just for listeners out there that don't, maybe haven't thought about the role that investors play in the market. Why do we need investors in real estate?
Right. So, we touched on the 3.9 million homes that need to be built and the $2 trillion investment that's required just in building costs. So that needs to come from private sources. There isn't enough money in Canada to build that from government funding. We cannot allocate $2 trillion to anything, including housing. So then the issue is who's going to finance that? Who's going to invest in that? And so it's going to have to be private investors, Canadians and foreigners. But we're basically telling people, whatever you do, don't invest in Canadian housing because we're going to tell you what you can and cannot do with your property. We're going to make it impossible to renovate. And we're going to tax you every way possible. We're going to increase your capital gain tax to the highest in the developed world. We're going to increase your property taxes. So people look at that and say, well, why would I ever do that when I can invest just south of the border and get, lower rents and lower returns, but no risk. And any investor would prefer no risk with slightly lower return.
Yeah, or even just a little further east in Alberta.
Or even just further east, yeah. So risk matters for investment tremendously. Obviously, there is a very clear relationship between risk and the required rate of return on an investment.
So if we're, and just to play this out, so where this really matters, I think, is in new construction, right? Like where you're going to raise... You have to sell a certain amount of a building in order to get financing to have a building go forward or get the private capital for purpose-built rental. But can we play out in your mind, Andre, like how this impacts prices if policy just remains the same and the rate of return required to invest in real estate is not attainable? What does that do to regular folks who are just looking to buy housing in this market? Like, does that mean, like, what does pricing look like because of these policies in, say, 5 years?
Well, when you constrain housing, new supply in rental housing, the way we are, then rents go up, and they are going up a lot despite rent control. And then, of course, when rents go up, more people would like to switch into owning a home. And especially with the declining interest rates, that becomes the more attractive option to buy rather than pay relatively high rents. So then more people switch into buying, but there's very little new construction. I mean, despite of what we are told, the actual completed units are very few. So and you have population growth, you have immigration, and you have people switching from rental to to buying, all these three forces increase demand for owner-occupied housing. We're not building really much of anything. The only thing that can possibly give is prices. So all these policies that make it very risky to invest in rental housing very quickly translate into higher prices for owner-occupied housing. Those markets are very highly linked.
What would good policy look like? And I know, you know, I think kind of at that level that we don't usually talk about undermining property rights, but like what is, I guess, is it just rolling back a lot of the regulation?
Yeah, but not rolling back, more like a sledgehammer to yeah, rolling, we've gone too far. So rolling is not going to do it. It's really removing all of this excess regulation that we've added over the past decade. So vacancy taxes, speculation taxes, additional school tax, the building code, all this stuff needs to go and really quite suddenly and quickly. And that will lower the cost of constructing new homes. And it will lower the cost of investing in housing because it will reduce the risk of investing in housing. And that's the only way we can get sufficient, meaningful supply increase, like the 3.9 million homes in Canada or whatever, 100,000 of that, or hopefully more than that in BC. That's the only way we can achieve this supply that we all would like to see. And that, in turn, whether it's housing, whether it's owner-occupied or rental, doesn't really matter. If it's owner-occupied, it will at least maintain the current prices and probably even reduce them. And if it's rental, that's even better. It will keep rents the same or reduce them without the need for rent control. That's really the only long-term sustainable solution. Absent that, if we make it difficult to build, which we are doing right now because it's costly to build and the risk to investing in building is so high, we're not going to get enough supply and we'll never have affordable housing.
Multiplexes and thinking about the increased density in the region, do you see this as a significant bump in land prices?
Well, first of all, that's a great idea. I love it. You know, obviously, some of that new supply that I'm advocating for needs to come on new land, but some is going to have to come on through densification. I get that, and that's a good thing. The issue is, as we already discussed, it's very difficult to make those projects work because of all the regulatory hurdles and risks we currently face. And then the other issue is, it's great to allow more density, but from what I understand, that increased density with fourplexes and sixplexes and all that came with actually reduced allowance if you want to build a single family home.
Yes.
And that's exactly the type of policy I'm criticizing because now it creates risk. So that's yet another layer of risk that says, oh, the government can now, it used to be that I can build that house and now I can't. It has to be a smaller house. So the government can arbitrarily, with the stroke of a pen, come and change your entire investment plan. And when you do that to existing owners, new potential investors are taking notice and are saying, well, fine, I'll need another 0.5% or percent higher rate of return because of that risk. Because today it was this and tomorrow it will be something else. And you add enough of those 0.5% or 1% required rate of return to compensate for this additional risk, you get nothing built.
You know, one thing that strikes me is we've always talked about, going back to the earliest episodes, about, you know, Vancouver being an attractive place because of political stability. And one thing about these policies over the last number of years is it seems like the rules of the game are changing fairly dramatically and impactfully. You know, taking a sledgehammer to these policies, as you say, is one thing, but do you think the idea of political stability or policy stability has been tarnished in a way that even if those rules were changed tomorrow, that people would be like, well, but wait a second, like, you know, we've seen dramatic changes over the last decade. What's to say, you know, a new government is elected and that's the case again? Yeah, I guess like that happens damage, anywhere, but
the damage has maybe been done in terms
of reputation
in the market, right?
But many countries have gone through that. They right. have had terrible governments that implemented bad policies, and eventually that gets repaired. It will take time for investors to gain confidence. So hopefully those removing all those measures, all those administrative obstacles will come with some assurance, at least from the government, that this is in place and we're going to respect property rights and your choices to make it easier and cheaper for you to build and faster. So that that will help to some extent. Of course, government can change. And so we really need safeguards in place that come down to property rights. There need to be limits on what government can do to erode property rights. So right. I think that's a cultural change, but also legal change. And I'm not a legal expert, but I'm sure there are ways to put that in place. And you're right on the uncertainty. So yes, we're no longer a place of stability. I mean, the biggest risk I see, even though I'm not an investor, I work on a salary from SFU, but even so, the biggest risk I see to my financial situation is the budget days, PC and yeah. Federal budget days. That is what the biggest risk I see every year. And once those are done, and if I somehow escape the bullets, then I'm good. The rest I can manage. If my teaching at SFU, somehow goes down, it there's no sign of that at all. But should it ever happen, well, I can pick up more teaching somewhere else. Right. Things I can adjust. When the government comes and raises your capital gain tax arbitrarily by 9 percentage points, that's something that's very difficult to adjust to. And it's retroactive, right? This is tax now on past capital gains. So this kind of, we really need to remove the ability for the government to do that kind of damage, especially retroactively.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
Maybe switching gears, Andre, one thing we've talked a lot about kind of policy and the challenges around building housing. Of course, we're in an interest rate environment that's made it a lot trickier for things, for any type of building to pencil. Can you talk about where we're at in terms of interest rates, where we're headed, where you think we'll be in the next year or two, and what impact that will have on the market?
So we've kept interest rates too high for too long. I think there's very little question about that. And the reason I say that is that the GDP growth per capita has been negative for 2 years now. So our income per capita has been declining for 2 years in Canada. Obviously, the GDP number is growing, but population is growing faster. Mm-hmm. So we are in a recession, and the appropriate measure is GDP per capita. That's economic growth. Growth of GDP just because of population growth, it's not economic growth, that's just population growth.
Right.
I think Bank of Canada recognizes that finally. Obviously, we had one cut. Everyone expects another cut coming up next week or in 2 weeks.
Right.
So hopefully that will be in place. and we're going to see much lower interest rates. But there is another aspect to this that people don't often consider, and that's the interplay between interest rates and inflation. So what matters for real estate, any long-term asset, is the real interest rate. So the real interest rate is the nominal interest rate minus the expected future inflation. So I was puzzled why prices, commercial and residential, why prices really didn't go down when we saw interest rates double and triple. After COVID, we went from what, basically zero to 5%.
Right.
So if you told me beforehand, and in fact, probably it came up on the show that Canadians, especially people in Vancouver, are overexposed. And if interest rates have that kind of move, that would be devastating for the housing market and the commercial market. But that did not happen. Sure, prices may have gone down a little bit here and there, maybe in commercial, but nothing like what we expected. And in retrospect, I think it is because we also had high inflation. So you have high interest rates, but you also have high inflation. So the true cost of that debt is not that high. Inflation has subsided now and interest rates are falling, but not fast enough. So actually the real interest rate right now is high for the first time in two decades.
So is that just thinking about this, the idea of the lag of the impact of an interest rate increase, is it actually like that? I've never thought of it the way you're putting it, but it's really that inflation now is whatever, at under 3%.
Yeah.
But the interest rate's still very high. So it's actually truly, the impact is now being felt. It's not necessarily the lag as much as the fact that inflation is coming down and the interest rates are still very high.
That's right.
Because it feels to me like the market is finally starting to really feel hurt a little bit in a way that last year didn't feel like that.
That's right.
Or 2022, it didn't feel like that. That's really an interesting...
So 2022, it was no problem. Even though we had high interest rates, if you have 5-6% rates of inflation, well, that inflation makes your mortgage payment. You still have to maintain the asset and not default on your mortgage. But if you wait a few years, you're fine because inflation alone appreciates your asset enough that covers all the mortgage payments, even at the 5% interest rate. Now, when inflation is lower, suddenly the same 5% interest rate becomes more costly because inflation doesn't cover it. So now you have to cover it. And interest rates have not been declining in line with inflation. And therefore, the real interest rate is actually now higher than it's ever been. So hopefully Bank of Canada will act fast again and do substantial reduction in interest rates so that again we get low or really zero real interest rates. And then we're going to be back on track. There's also another small issue there, which is people are anticipating lower rates. So now they're waiting. There's no pressure to buy because you know that you think, I mean, you're reasonably sure that in 6 months you're going to have lower interest rates. And you're like, you know what, let me wait 6 months and I'll get a much cheaper mortgage. I get that. The issue with that is if everyone's doing that, then in 6 months when we do get the lower rates, prices are going to be higher.
Of course, yeah. And I'm actually seeing that, especially before Bank of Canada meetings now, things get really, really slow in the couple of weeks leading up to them because people say, well, let's just see what happens at the meeting, right? And
yeah, so that's great. Again, that thinking, very dangerous because our track record as economists of predicting interest rates or housing prices is terrible. Terrible. And I mean, mine certainly, but that's not a surprise to anyone. I think the profession's track record is terrible. So the moment you start playing that kind of game, oh, how can I slice this thinner and finer and wait for the perfect moment, that usually doesn't work. It works by luck for some people, but not for the majority of people.
And the herd mentality in this market too, like these demand shocks that we get when everyone feels like it's the time to go is never good for the market as well, right? So it's the only thing right now
never
is...
Never fun to be a buyer in those moments.
Well, yeah. The only thing I'm thinking about now, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this, Andre, but in the last, call it 6 months, we've seen inventory almost double in the region. Any thoughts on why we're seeing an uptick in of inventory?
So the inventory is up because listings are up.
Right.
So it's mostly the supply side. And that is probably because a whole bunch of people are waiting for interest rates to come down.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to sell when buyers are struggling. So finally, interest rates start coming down. And probably everyone who was thinking about selling anyway is now saying, well, interest rates are lower. Maybe I can get a slightly better price. So they list at the same time. Buyers, on the other hand, are probably saying, well, I'm going to wait for a little bit lower interest rates.
Right.
I know they've come down and that's a good thing. I'm going to wait a little longer to see even lower interest rates.
This is the best analysis of inventory I think I've heard.
We asked
this question every single episode, and I think that is exactly it. I think sellers have been waiting to time the sale with the interest rates, right? If they've been thinking about selling in the last few years, and now that it's finally here, it's go time. And buyers, on the other hand, are not responding the way people would typically think. Oh, rates are coming down. Time to jump in. They're actually responding.
Waiting.
They're moving to the sidelines.
Because
now we have this buildup of inventory. I mean, that is, I think that's bang on.
So the danger with that is eventually we're going to get to interest rates that we think are going to be stable. Because everyone now says interest rates are coming down,
yeah.
Right? Okay, fine. But maybe we have a change in leadership. Maybe something else happens. The economy picks up. Productivity picks up, even though it will take a bit of a miracle for that to happen. But miracles do happen. So eventually we're going to get to a point where people expect stable interest rates, not declining, stable. And that's when buyers are going to come in, because then there's no incentive to wait. Whether you wait or not, you're getting the same interest rate.
Yeah.
The problem with that thing, I get that intuition and thinking, I get it. But if everyone does exactly the same thinking, then it's going to be impossible to find something you like when that does happen. So if I'm thinking of buying, I would actually use this moment to find the property I like. And if you're so worried that interest rates are going to go down further and you're going to miss out on a deal, well, get a variable rate mortgage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That way you benefit from your conviction that appears to be very firm, that interest rates are coming down. So benefit from that conviction and yet find a property when there's some selection.
I think right now the idea of this rate cut in July is, you know, if you go to the markets, it's like whatever, 87% or something like that. Like most people think there's going to be a quarter point. I'm kind of curious, do you feel like, you know, you've already said rates have been too high for too long. Do you think the Bank of Canada now is on a clear path where are we at the end of the year?
Well, it's hard to predict what Bank of Canada will do. They have made mistakes in the past, and I wouldn't be surprised if they make mistakes in the future. But as I said, GDP per capita has been declining for 2 years. Canada is in a recession. The only reason we have positive actual GDP growth is population growth.
Mm-hmm.
That's not economic growth. So rates should have been coming down long ago and much, much deeper. Hopefully that will happen going forward. One thing that will help is that inflation in the U.S. is also lower,
mm-hmm.
and also bond yields are lower. So that may help, because I get it, Canada can't lower interest rates too much more than the U.S. We can be, you know, a couple of, you know, basis points lower, you know, maybe a quarter of a percent, half a percent. But the moment we get more than 1% difference, that creates all kinds of other issues. But we're in a situation now where Canada economically is clearly struggling. And the U.S. Not struggling economically. The U.S. is doing just fine. But inflation is lower. So hopefully the combination of these forces will induce Canada to Bank of Canada to lower interest rates like they should.
Andre, we promised we'd get you out of here at 11:30, and it's 11:31. We have this segment called the Five Wire, Five Lighthearted Questions that we end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
Sure, yes.
This podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform. Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects.
Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yale Town, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the pre-sale world on fire without a spark.
Question number one is one book you've read recently that you would recommend.
You know what? I have three little kids, and one of them is becoming a teenager, a 13-year-old. So I'm reading books on how to talk to him, which I find fascinating. The most recent one is how to talk to children so they listen, how to listen to children, so, you know, something like that. But how to talk to children so they listen.
God, I should read that.
And I tell you, like, this book, even though I read it so that I can talk to my kids more effectively, it has changed the way I talk to adults a lot more than the way I talk to my kids. It's basic stuff. That's nothing revolutionary. It's like, oh, you have to establish a connection first before you start demanding and asking. And I'm like, well, you mean not the command and control guy that I appear to be when I show up in the room? So to me, that's revolutionary. I don't know if I can recommend it to many people, but to me, it has been fantastic.
Great. In the last few years, or even last year, maybe, because we've probably asked you this in the past, what new belief, behavior, or habit has improved your life?
Oh, I play a lot of tennis. I've always played some, but I've really...
Man, you must have a crazy serve.
I do. You know what? I just, a coach was walking by one of my tennis practices, a very senior guy, and he says, looks at me and he says, Andre, I'll tell you one thing about your serve. If you're not getting 1 point per game for free with your serve, you have to ask questions.
Yeah.
And I look at my serve and I'm nowhere near getting it. So that was a very polite way to say, Andre, you have the height and the strength and all that, but you really suck.
You should have a good serve. That's great. Question number three. What have you been binge watching lately, or a movie show recommendation?
Oh my goodness. That's where you're going to... I listened to the Vancouver Real Estate podcast. There's just no time. Well, I told you, I just came back from a long trip where that was pretty exhausting. So I don't think I watched TV for 6 weeks at all. I mean, and I mean even shows on the screen or anything. So
right.
But I find that refreshing. There's so many other beautiful things in life, you know.
Speaking of maybe an audible here for number four, not an audible recommendation, but you were just in Singapore and Thailand.
Yes.
Favorite place?
Yeah, maybe a highlight.
You know what? I'm always impressed with Singapore and, of course, their housing policy, which is not perfect. There is a lot of government intervention and regulation, but it somehow works. And they have like 80-90% home ownership rate. Not all of it is free market. A lot of it is through government incentives and intervention and subsidies. So I'm not saying that's the perfect example, but they really have achieved something that's very impressive. And we should learn from them. And then there is kind of an Irish pub on the Singapore River where they have big screens TV to show the Euro Cup games.
Oh, yeah.
So I watched a couple of Euro Cup games right there and then, and that was a lifelong memory. That was so much fun.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. I watched the last Euro in Thailand, and it was, it's funny, but I have similar memories. Yeah,
you know, it's somehow there's something different about being in a remote foreign country.
Totally.
And everyone is kind of like you.
Yeah.
But the level of excitement, I think, was higher than than what it would be. Well, I don't know, higher than in Europe, but certainly higher than what it would have been here.
For sure. Last question, something that you've purchased recently for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life.
Oh, a tennis racket?
Man, I kind of want to watch you play.
No, I'm not a big shopper. I don't think I've ever bought anything for $1,500.
Are you playing at UBC tennis or?
I've done that. Yeah. It's good. Hard to book. I tell you, like, it great facility, fantastic, perfect. But there could be an improvement to the reservation system.
I feel like that's everywhere, anywhere that allows the public to play tennis. The system's archaic and garbage.
So why is that? You have the infrastructure, which is the hard and expensive thing, and it's perfect. It's really well designed facility. It's awesome, but. I mean, people can design a better reservation system for $10,000 or maybe even less. Like, what's the big deal?
A couple of years ago, we were playing in North Van, and you literally still have to call the day before.
It's like a window
at 7:30 in the morning, and you can wake up and have three guys dialing, and you'll never get a court. It's like, this can't be the best way to allocate. It's unbelievable. That's a City of North Van facility, but it seems like in Vancouver, at least, it's very hard to, unless you're at one of the
I think
clubs.
It's even district, but
yeah.
Well,
is that district?
I think so.
But the City of Vancouver has been improving some of the tennis courts. I don't know if they built any new ones, but you know, I see new nets, new paint. So that's a very good thing. But that only works in the summer. We have nothing really for the winter.
Well, we'll leave it there, but how can people find out more about what you're up to?
I was just going
to
move to pickleball, but I guess we'll leave it there.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm on Twitter, Andrei D. Pavlov, Andrei_D_Pavlov. So I tweet now and again, try to stay out of trouble unsuccessfully, but I try. And of course, if you just type Andrei Pavlov at SFU, you'll come to my webpage at SFU where you can see all my research. And
you're putting your articles on your site.
I do. Once every 6 months, so they're not as current as they should be, but I will today.
You know, and I have to say, I'm trying to remember, I don't remember who, it's happened more than once. People say, oh yeah, I love hearing Andre on the show. I was actually his student, and they're usually in the development industry, but I've heard that more than once from people that we're connecting with.
Well, I teach a real estate course. And
now it's, but you got a lot of big fans. Yeah, you got a lot of big fans out there.
It's going to be offered more now, more sections, because it's so popular. And I love that. Like talking to people with some are experienced developers, but some have no background and no preconception of how things should be. And talking to them and in class and discussing issues is so refreshing because you see how people with no background think about these issues.
Well, fantastic. Thanks again for joining us, Andre. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
There you have it, folks. Our discussion with Andre Pavlov, professor of finance at the SFU Beattie School of Business.
There's few people that I like having in studio as much as I like having Andre Pavlov pop by. I feel like if he'd come on every show, I'd have him.
The stuff about interest rates and kind of nominal and real interest rates in relation to inflation as leading to the inventory influx this year was really mind-blowing. And I love this idea that people, you know, held off and decided, hey, you know what? We're over the hump. We're on the back nine. Let's list.
And then buyers.
And buyers sensing the uncertainty in the environment, in the situation, even if it's all good news coming in terms of interest
They're
rates.
Like, great. We'll wait.
Yeah.
We'll wait for the rates are only coming down.
It seems so obvious now.
Can't be unseen.
Exactly. But no, it was great having Andre in the studio for sure. I think he was taking his kid to basketball after. And I got to say, I bet his kid is a force on the basketball court.
Are you saying that? Because Andre's over
six. He's a tall glass of water. He's
maybe
a tall glass of water.
He's got to be 6'6".
Yeah. I said to him after we cut the talk, he's got a lot of people who listen to the show that are big fans of his ex-students. I've talked to many people that mention being former students of Andre's. So yeah. It's great having him back, as always.
You really pressed him on his tennis serve. Little aggressive.
I mean, I feel like that, he's though. Modest.
He's got to just be modest. He's a crappy tennis serve by him must just be insane.
I feel now like I'm maybe underestimating his height. He's got to be.
He's very tall. I mean, like
Jordan's,
I remember
6'6", right? Is that Jordan? I feel like
Michael Jordan.
Yeah, Michael. Oh, yeah. Well, I call him Jordan.
His friends call him Jordan.
Yeah, but he's 6'6". So yeah. I'm just thinking, and I've never met him, so I have no.
Where's the reference here? Zero context.
Yeah. I like sports. That's what that says.
Yeah. Anyway, it was great having him in, and he's definitely probably got a hell of a tennis serve. There's no question.
Yeah, Matt, what else do we have before we cut for the day?
What else do we have? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the LiveWire. This is our weekly mailer with VIP presale access and different presales. It's an interesting time to be watching that market. We also have Deal of the Month. We have stats, different types of stats, sales ratios where you can monitor neighborhoods and price bands and really get into the nitty gritty. Those go out for free every time they're available at the end of each month. And we also have, of course, tried and true private client services.
Yeah, Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still with the rest of us. Power walk by, you get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. It is really a great time to be monitoring. And okay, if you're taking anything away from these shows we're having now, inventory doubled basically in the last 6 months. Sales volume down, generally speaking.
20% below the 10-year average. And
rates coming
here's
down.
Here's the kicker. In a week, we're probably seeing a rate cut.
There's a 90% chance?
Yeah.
88%? Yeah. Has that gone up probably since?
It's probably 92 by now.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, the point is that if you're thinking about buying real estate, maybe start monitoring.
Here's the thing I've been thinking about in relation to what Andre said, and I think if I was smarter, I would have been able to ask him this question, is if rates now in relation to inflation are extremely high, and that's part of why the listings have increased, how dramatically do they have to fall before it spurs a lot of activity? Because a quarter point, if we're under 3% for inflation and we're at 5%, you know?
Save that for 2025.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, if you want to talk about that, then maybe don't call me, call Andre, but you can reach me at any time, 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line info at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week. We're back here with another great episode next week.
We're stacking them right now. It's unreal.
This is going to be great. So have a great week and we'll see you next week.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.